understand that I need to make the general announcement. This is, I'm Richard Swanson, it is June 12th, maybe?
Yes.
Good. And it's 2008, and we're doing an investigation, exploration of origin stories. So, because they're recording this, and that helps them figure out where things are. We have messed with a few things so far. We land today on this continent, but in a culture as unlike anything I've ever lived in as it's possible to be, because we're looking today at Hopi origin stories. It is a fascinating thing to visit Hopi villages, a fascinating thing to meet the Hopi communities, because in my very limited experience, I know a thimbleful about most of this. In my very limited experience, they are exceedingly hospitable communities. And it is also very clear that you do not live here. That is, in fact, how the Hopi have preserved themselves and their sense of themselves in the face of very aggressive outsiders. They, alone of Native American nations, found a way very successfully to push Christian missionaries away and keep them away. The Franciscans showed up, the Hopi conversed with them and listened a while and said, thanks, but no thanks, and pulled the ladders up. And Franciscans sat at the bottom wondering what to do next. The Hopi have done that through their whole history. When I visited First Mesa with a class that Martin Brokenleg and I taught together, we walked around, we talked with people, we met folk, we listened, we watched, we sat still. Martin said, it's wise to sit still, and so we sat still. And then a member of the community took us out to Walpi, which is the old village out on the end of the mesa that looks out over the edge of the mesa. It is the very oldest part. And come on into the circle, we're going to do circle stuff again. It's the part of First Mesa that does not have electricity. It's the part that does not have running water. It's the part where the oldest, most traditional, and smallest part of the First Mesa community lives. Dwindling because no electricity and no running water may be fine and traditional, but it's hard life and less attractive life. But we were out there with someone who lived in Walpi, and he was showing us this house and that house, telling us this story and that story. And the students were listening, and all of us at that point had learned that we were understanding and misunderstanding, always useful to know. He took us to the edge of the mesa, and he said, now, the houses I showed you are the newer houses, but down there on that next little flat spot is where we used to live. That's where we lived, and then we moved up here. And the students said, oh, well, so when did you live down there? And our guide, our storyteller, said, well, we lived down there until the Spanish came. The sense of the depth of time was overwhelming for me, because suddenly I felt like I was in deeper water than I dared swim in. I know you swim only in the water you're in, but there's something about knowing that the water falls away 4 centuries under you that does get one's attention. But his sense appeared to be, and the Hopi sense appeared to be, that time was a small puddle, and they were standing next to where they used to live, though no one had lived there in hundreds of years. That means that this marvelous community experiences everything about the world in a way that leaves me spinning. And that's important to know when we play with this story. I'm going to hand this round, as we've done each other time, and I'm going to ask you, if you would, when it comes to you, would you tell us your name and tell us what it is that is for you joy? Now, I've tried to make that sentence as ambiguous and bizarre as possible. I did not say what makes you happy. I asked you what it is that is for you joy. And we're going to go this way, so start preparing, and I'll hand it to you in just a little bit. So start thinking. My name is Richard Swanson. And joy for me is connection. Connection between ideas, connection between people, connection between things that seem impossibly separate. That for me is joy.
My name is Sandy Jackson, and joy for me is relationship with God.
My name is Justin Cannon. Joy for me would be being able to spiritually connect with another person.
My name is Carolyn Albert, and I would like a few more hours to think about this question.
Joy for you would be another couple of hours.
However, after a moment, I would say that joy for me is being with someone and knowing that I care about what they want to say and that they care about what I want to say.
I'm Larry Huff, and one joy for me is about my Nikika, especially when it goes bonus
My name is Gail Johnson, and joy for me is being involved in and hearing a good discussion.
I'm Patty Osterholm, and I've been the oldest member of this community for the last year. And when you get to a certain age, you have many joys. And I would say just the fact that when I wake up in the morning and can sit up in bed, swing my legs over and stand up, is a very joyful feeling.
My name is Kristen Zwangi, and joy for me is helping others and seeing other people smile.
My name is Mark Johnson, and joy for me is riding my motorcycle in the back roads of the Pacific Northwest.
My name is Nick Martin, and joy for me is found in the beauty of simplicity.
My name is Larry Crosby. Joy for me is besting my opponent in a good appellate argument.
Who say it again, please?
Besting my opponent in a good appellate argument.
Very nice, yes.
I'm Eric Holland, and joy for me often involves tears.
I'm Liz Rossman, and I find joy in light.
I'm Jill Stevenson. Right now, I find joy in the outdoors.
And me, I'm Iona Erickson, and what am I supposed to tell you?
What is for you joy?
What is for me joy? I believe it's music. I just really, I play the violin and a little bit on the piano, but for my own entertainment. I'm not that good, you see. But I enjoy doing that. I take my violin off and play, and I lose myself.
Old broken down trombonist. I love to listen to music, but I would 20 times rather play it than listen to it. Although I do know that the definition of a gentleman is someone who can play trombone but does not.
I'm Zach Swanson, and joy for me is seeing that people actually care about me.
Okay. One of the first things that you notice. These pieces that we've looked at over the last few days come from a source book, Primal Myths, edited by Barbara Sproul. I've decided that's how I will say her name. And all of the pieces are excerpts. If when she excerpts from cultures that I know more about, I know that she is, even in a long piece, excerpted from a much longer piece. But for all of that, the pieces we've had have been shortish, all in all. The first thing you notice about the Hopi origin story is that it is not short. Many of the myths from around the world, many of the stories, many of the things that bring the world into being are in fact lengthy. But the Hopi story, perhaps because of the way time does not function in Hopi, in a world where Hopi live, the story is very long and in fact has four stages in Sproul's compendium, and that's a small part of the actual Hopi story. But there are four stages in Sproul's compendium, and we're doing less than one of them. So when we are done looking at the piece we're looking at, we will have brought less than a quarter of the Hopi world into being, just so you know. If we were to read the entire thing that Sproul has for us, we would, in fact, do nothing but read for the next hour, and we shall not do that. I would like, because of the length of this, to proceed somewhat differently today. I would like to ask if there is someone who would read the first chunk, Tokpela, the First World. That's on page 269, and it's that first chunk down to Spider-Woman and the Twins. If someone would read that, what I'm going to ask you to do is just listen. And then, when you've listened, I'm going to ask one more person to read it. And when you've done that, I'm going to ask you to glom into groups of three or so, I'm not counting, and find with your glom group of three, three things that snagged you, and then we'll go on from there, okay? Could I ask someone to read? Thank you.
Tokpela, the First World. The first world was Tokpela, which means endless space. But first, they say, there was only the creator, Tewa. All else was endless space. There was no beginning and no end, no time, no shape, no life. Just an immeasurable void that had its beginning and end, time, shape, and life, in the mind of Tewa, the creator. Then he, the infinite, conceived the finite. First, he created Satutne to make it manifest, saying to him, I have created you, the first power and instrument as a person, to carry out my plan for life in endless space. I am your uncle. You are my nephew. Go now and lay out these universes in proper order, so they may work harmoniously with one another according to my plan. So Tuknang did as he was commanded. From endless space he gathered that which was to be manifest as solid substance, molded it into forms, and arranged them into nine universal kingdoms, one for Tewa, the creator, one for himself, and seven universes for the life to come. Finishing this, So Tuknang went to Tewa and asked, is this according to your plan? It is very good, said Tewa. Now I want you to do the same thing. Waters. Place them on the surfaces of these universes so they will be divided equally among all and each. So Sotukne gathered from endless space that which was to be manifest as the waters and placed them on the universes so that each would be half solid and half water. Going now to Tewa, he said, I want you to see the work I have done, and if it pleases you. It is very good, Tewa said. The next thing now is to put the forces of air into peaceful movement about all. This So Tuknang did. From endless space he gathered that which was to be manifest as the airs, made them into great forces, and arranged them into gentle, ordered movements around each universe. Tewa was pleased. You have done a great work according to my plan, nephew. You have created the universes and made them manifest in solids, waters, and winds, and put them in their proper places. But your work is not yet finished. Now you must create life and its movements to complete the four parts. To Apache, of my universal plan.
Could I ask for one more reader? Thank you.
Topola, the first world. The first world was Topola, endless space. But first, they say, there was only the creator, Taiwa. All else was endless space. There was no beginning and no end, no time, no shape, no life. Just an immeasurable void that had its beginning and end, time, shape, and life in the mind of Taiwa, the creator. Then he, the infinite, conceived the finite. First he created Sotup name to make it manifest, saying to him, I have created you, the first power and instrument as a person, to carry out my plan for life in endless space. I am your uncle. You are my nephew. Go now and lay out these universes in proper order so they may work harmoniously with one another according to my plan. So Tugnang did as he was commanded. From endless space, he gathered that which was to be manifest as solid substance, molded it into forms, and arranged them into 9 universal kingdoms. One for Taiwa the creator, one for himself, and 7 universes for the life to come. Finishing this, Soktubnang went to Taiwa and asked, is this according to your plan? It's very good, said Taiwa. Now I want you to do the same thing with the waters. Place them on the surfaces of these universes so they will be divided equally among all and each. So Soktubnang gathered from endless space that which was to be manifest as the waters, and placed them on the universes, so that each would be half solid and half water. Going now to Taiwa, he said, I want you to see the work I have done, and if it pleases you. It is very good, said Taiwa. The next thing now is to put the forces of air into peaceful movement about all. This Soktubnang did. From the endless space, he gathered that which was to be manifest as the airs, made them into great forces, and arranged them into gentle, ordered movements around each universe. Taiwa was pleased. You have done a great work according to my plan, nephew. You have created the universes and made them manifest in solids, waters, and winds, and put them in their proper places. But your work is not yet finished. Now you must create life and its movement to complete the 4 parts to a Quachi of my universal plan.
Thank you. Thank you. Now if you would glom groups of 2, 3, whatever, and come up with your group, something like 3 things that snagged your ear. Okay?
So the creator imagines
the word
That is interesting.
Okay, you got your sense.
Creates another being to carry out.
What I'm gonna ask you next is, out of each group, one thing.
It's almost like one day.
One of the three. Pick one of the three things you came up with, and we're gonna go around and get them all in the air.
Which one?
Just what's the page?
Okay, are you ready? Okay. Who wants to go first? Okay, you're up.
We're curious about the nine universal kingdoms, especially, and we do have no idea what the seven universes for the life to come is all about.
Right. And the story doesn't say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know if that was reincarnational or what. So,
yeah.
And then, of course, seven is perfection, so we thought.
At least in a Jewish system.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Does that have anything to do with in this system? We didn't know.
And you listen with the only ears you've got.
Yep.
The ears you've got, hear seven and say, aha. But the story just says 9117.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whatever. Okay? Who wants to go next?
The relationship that is uncle and nephew who are involved in this creation.
Anybody know anything about uncles and nephews in Native American systems?
Well, I was talking, I don't know about Hopi, but where we're from, South Dakota,
Indeed. The
relationship of a father's brother being like your father.
And in fact, in some ways more important than your father. Likewise, a mother's sister. Aunties are crucial, uncles are crucial. When Martin and I traveled to the Southwest, we ran into this piece, and Martin says, as near as he can understand, this is similar between, this is a similarity between the Hopi and the Lakota. There are very few similarities between the Hopi and the Lakota. But this was one that he thought was probably one. Because a father and a mother, they're very important. We come equipped, each of us, with one of each. But to raise a child, you in fact need aunties and uncles. An auntie is anyone who acts like an auntie to you. She may be related to you in ways that are clear and fit on a great Western European genealogical chart. My mother's sister is my aunt. But an auntie isn't someone just who's related to you that way. It may be that she's related to you in such a complex way that only your grandmother understands how. Or she may have no blood relationship to you at all. But an auntie is someone who acts like an auntie. An uncle is someone who teaches a young man how to live. And an uncle is anyone who does that for a young man. For a young woman too, but we have male relationship here. It's interesting that the Creator creates not a son, but a nephew. It may be that that's because the Creator teaches and therefore checks on how the nephew is living. My friend Martin was in college, and he was coming home from college, driving the car that we all drove in college. The wheels wobble, the radio works every once in a while, and the heater only works well in the summer. It was fall, and he was driving, and the tires, all of them bald. One of them decided it would also like to be flat, so it went flat, very flat. He opened the trunk and discovered that the spare tire was bald. It was also flatter than the flat tire on the car. So that left him outside of a little town by himself in rural South Dakota. This is not always the best place for a Native American to be by himself out along the road. It's not the worst place, but it can be a bad place. He walked to town and called his mother. Always a good idea when you don't know whether you're safe or not. So he called his mother and she said, "I'm so glad you are there because you have an auntie in that town." Martin had never heard of her. But his mother said, "You call your auntie, she will take care of you." Martin Paul, his auntie. She said, "Nephew, I'm so glad you called. I was just thinking of you. I knew you would call me." Things like this happen to Martin all the time. I don't understand. His auntie said, "You stay put. Your uncle will come and get you." His uncle came and got him, delivered him to his auntie's house. His auntie fed him, and then she fed him, and then she fed him. She told him stories, and then she fed him again. She said, "You look skinny. You should eat." I think sometimes Lakota should be Jewish. There's something about the "you should eat." After more meals than Martin could count, his uncle drove up in the car and said, "I think it's okay now." It was indeed. There were 5 new tires. The car had been washed. The fluids had been changed. This is what an uncle does, and the auntie made sure that it was right. This story is that kind of a relationship. They don't have to have met, but an uncle is an uncle when he acts like an uncle. Do you see Tiowa acting like an uncle in this story? Do you see Satuknan acting like a nephew?
Checking.
Is this
what you had in mind?
Yes. This is teaching a nephew how to be a nephew. Because of course, the first question in any origin story, the real question is, how do we live in this world? And the answer in every origin story is, here would be how. "Uncle, have I done it according to your plan?" And the uncle looks and says, "Oh, it's very good." Notice he doesn't say, "You've done it according to my plan." It may mean that, but what he says is, "Oh, it's very good." Which could mean, in fact, that the uncle's plan is for the nephew to figure out how to do it. Story doesn't say. But the uncle and the nephew check back and forth with each other.
Also,
else you see? Yes.
When the uncle says, "It's very good," it may not be perfect.
True.
There may be some flaws in it, but the uncle said, "It's good.
It's good." And that can mean all sorts of things. But at the very, at the heart of it, it means, my uncle just said, I did it as it should be. Did I do it perfect? There may be no such thing as perfect, but I did it as it should be. Whatever precisely my uncle means, I will learn. Notice Tiowa doesn't ask, or Satuknan doesn't ask how to do it. He does it, and then asks if it was according to the plan. And then he doesn't ask what exactly it means that it's very good. A student of mine, Wade Lone Elk, full-blooded Lakota, tells me that his grandfather is just like that, because when grandfather tells you something, you do not ask what, why, how, or anything else. Grandfather will tell you when it's time for you to know that next part. Satuknan, perhaps, like Wade Lone Elk, knows that Tiowa has told him all that he needs to tell him. And if there are other things he should know, Tiowa will tell him when it is time. And since it's not time, he doesn't ask. There may be some structured relationship here like that too. Okay, which group is next? Yes?
We noticed that the Creator isn't directly involved with creating the worlds.
Oh, what does the Creator do in this story? He creates the one who creates the world. What else does Creator do in this story?
He celebrates the Creator.
He celebrates. This is an important job. And nothing happens without Creator celebrating. That's really nice.
He imagines too.
Yes.
And the one who catches on to the imaginings is the nephew.
Yes. How do you catch on to someone's imagining?
Live with them.
Yeah. Because then you can. The relationship is necessary. How does Satuknan know what to do? He lives with Tiowa. That's what nephews and uncles do. And when you live with your uncle, you do know how your uncle works. I was 7 years a butcher. Through undergrad and my first graduate degree, learned to cut meat in an old-fashioned butcher shop. I learned from O.J. Leon, and then I worked further with Amos Fink, who was they're both extremely good butchers, and Amos Finkel looked exactly like Popeye the Sailor. But in each case, especially with Amos, we worked in a very small space. The cutting room was very, very small. We could not both stand and walk abreast from one end to the other. We had to walk past each other. And this is a small room with power tools and very sharp knives. But we never ran into each other once we learned to live together and work together, because I could feel what Amos was going to do, and I would get out of his way without him needing to tell me. He could feel what I was going to do, and he would be out of my way before I got there. It's what an uncle and a nephew do. They live together, they work together, so that they can feel what has to be next. I know what my uncle is doing. He will be moving to his right very shortly. I will move out of his way so that my uncle can go where he must go, and he will move out of my way so that I can do what I must do. That's the kind of feel I have here. Another group. But that's a good one. Say it again.
The fact that it's a finite future that's created. But that's kind of like what Zach offered.
Yeah, with an extra edge. The creator creates the one who actually does the work. But the creator is infinite. And Sotoknan is a creation, and therefore, in some sense, finite, because he has a beginning. It's an interesting characteristic in the story. Anything else?
Do we run into creedal problems in that?
Oh, what's that?
Do we run into creedal problems in that?
No, only if there are Aryan Hopis. An inside joke. But in fact, early Christian argumentation went exactly over this ground and entertained a solution, in fact, very like this. That the creator created a being who would, in fact, carry out the bringing all things into being, and nothing was made without him. Apart from him, was not anything made that was made. But that solution was rejected by the Christian movement, but it is a structure in some ways similar to what the Hopi see in here. Interesting. Let's do the next chunk. Could I ask for a reader for Spider-Woman and the Twins? This is a longer piece. We'll read this just once. Could I ask for a reader? Okay, thank you.
Spider-Woman and the Twins, Sotoknan, went to the universe wherein was that to be, there's some problems here, Tvokpela, the first world, and out of it he created her, who was to remain on that earth and be his helper. Her name is Kukgangwutti, Spider-Woman. Then she awoke to life and received her name. And she asked, when she awoke to life and received her name, she asked, why am I here? Look about you, answered Sotoknan. Here is this earth we have created. It has shape and substance, direction and time, a beginning and an end. But there is no life upon it. We see no joyful movement. We hear no joyful sound. What is life without sound and movement? So you have been given the power to help us create this life. You have been given the knowledge, wisdom, and love to bless all the beings you create. That is why you are here. Following his instructions, Spider-Woman took some earth, mixed with it some Tugvala, liquid from mouth, saliva, and molded into two beings. Then she covered them with a cape made of white substance, which was the creative wisdom itself, and sang the creation song over them. When she uncovered them, the two beings, twins, sat up and asked, who are we? Why are we here? To the one on the right, Spider-Woman said, you are Pokanghoya, and you are to help keep this world in order when life is put upon it. Go now around all the world and put your hands upon the earth so that it will become fully solidified. This is your duty. Spider-Woman then said to the twin on the left, you are Palangahoya, and you are to help keep this world in order when life is put upon it. This is your duty now. Go about all the world and send out sound so that it may be heard throughout all the land. When this is heard, you will also be known as Echo, for all sound echoes the Creator. Pocahontas, traveling throughout the earth, solidified the higher reaches into great mountains. The lower reaches he made firm, but still pliable enough to be used by those beings to be placed upon it, and they would call it their mother. Palangahoya, traveling throughout the earth, sounded out his call as he was bidden. All the vibratory centers along the earth's axis from pole to pole resounded his call. The whole earth trembled. The universe quivered in tune. Thus he made the whole world an instrument of sound, and sound an instrument for carrying messages, resounding praise to the Creator of all. This is your voice, Uncle, Sotekna said to Taiowa. Everything is tuned to your sound. It is very good, said Taiowa. When they had accomplished their duties, Pocahontas was sent to the north pole of the world axis, and Palangahoya to the south pole, where they were jointly commanded to keep the world properly rotating. Pocahontas was also given the power to keep the earth in a stable form of solidness. Palangahoya was given the power to keep the air in gentle, ordered movement, and instructed to send out his call for good or for warning through the vibratory centers of the earth. These will be your duties in time to come, said Spider-Woman. She then created from the earth trees, bushes, plants, flowers, all kinds of seed bearers and nut bearers to clothe the earth, giving to each a life and name. In the same manner, she created all kinds of birds and animals, molding them out of earth, covering them with her white substance cape and singing over them. Some she placed to her right, some to her left, others before and behind her, indicating how they should spread to all four corners of the earth to live. Sutapna was happy, seeing how beautiful it all was, the land, the plants, the birds and animals, and the power working through them all. Joyfully, he said to Taiowa, come, see what our world looks like now. It is very good, said Taiowa. It is ready now for human life, the final touch to complete our plan.
Excuse me. Does anyone have a mint? Or anything I can suck upon?
Can I have some gum?
That would be great. You ever get the tickle in your throat that makes your eyes water? This is one of them. The question I'm going to ask is, what do you hear? What do you know? What's nagged you?
Is this a matriarchal society?
It is.
Are hopeless matriarchal?
Yes, no. Perhaps less matriarchal than are the Lakota, actually. But yet, matriarchal, women play a strong and central role, and they are the anchoring role in any community for hope. Thank you. And you can hear it in the story.
It seemed more than just from the woman comes life. It seemed more of a position of honor.
Yes. Yes, very definitely.
I noticed that they call on something that I don't think that the Europeans call on to until probably maybe the hopeless, I'm not sure. That the earth has two axes.
Mm-hmm.
So that means they knew it was round.
This is a creation story that has a globe in it that rotates. Mm-hmm. And while one of the things that excites me about origin stories is that they all seem to be agglomerative stories. All oral stories are agglomerative. They run into something new and they grab it and pull it inside. But origin stories may be more than any other kind of story. Whenever they encounter something new in culture, they pick it up and pull it inside and do something with it. That's because of the importance of origin stories, I think. So it's possible that this is the result of contact with Europeans. The Franciscans did know that the world rotated, and it's possible that they listened to that and said, good, we'll take it, thank you. Go down the ladder, please, we'll let you know when we're interested in more. But it is also possible that on the basis of their observations, they simply drew this conclusion. There is, until our lifetime, no one has been outside of the Earth to see that it's round. It's always been a conclusion we've drawn from observations. They have very good eyes. Very nice. What else caught your ear? Yes.
Well, I was surprised because when he first talked about the first twin who was on the right, and then they talked about the other twin on the left, I thought for sure this was going to be the good and the evil.
Yes.
Or the yang and the yang.
But
so I was surprised that they're both good.
And they're both doing things that are really pretty much related.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's something in our love of a polar opposites that puts me expecting exactly what you expected.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing to know about our understanding of our world. We do think that there are two sides to every issue. There are not. There are 35 in the decent issue. We do think that we do best if we can figure out who the good guys are and the bad guys are. Stories tend to have white hats and black hats. This story, at least in what we encounter, we have such a small bit of data. This is an itty-bitty little thimble we're looking at here, people. You know. But in this itty-bitty little thimble, there isn't a polar opposition being set up. There's a right hand and a left hand, and they do the same thing. Not quite the same thing. They have different responsibilities, but they are all about solidifying. Yeah.
But,
thank you.
But you can, you can see what one twin does. The earth becomes solid. And whatever what the other twin is doing, you can't see. It's the visible and the invisible.
Yes.
But it's all part of creation.
And what the other twin does, the echo twin needs the solidity of surfaces for echoes to work. But what the other twin does, if you read farther, even just in Sproul, you discover that what the other twin does is create the possibility of humans knowing what ought to be done, because human beings have a soft spot on the top of their head. The next section, we'll read that. And that soft spot, later in the story, is the place where the vibrations of the voice of the Creator are heard. And so Echo Twin, making it possible for all of the universe to resound with the voice of Tiowa, makes it possible for human beings to hear the true story of creation and respond to it. So you need the solid surfaces, you need the echo twin, so that human beings who are not yet in the world can be appropriately oriented. Yes?
It sounds like if there were actually people like that, and they were at the axis,
mm-hmm.
if you were to take out one of them, human life would collapse.
You need to read the rest of the story. There are four parts, stages to the Hopi story. In the first stage, human beings will be brought in very shortly and they live in unity and they have a strong sense of their own identity, and then they withdraw into their own little fragmented identities and create evil in the world, discord. And because of that, Tiowa destroys that world. How? By taking the controllers of the rotation off, and the world wobbles off and everything dies. People, however, are protected, who still follow the true story of creation, and they reemerge into a second world. And in the second world, they live together and they live well until commerce comes in, and commerce is a good thing, except commerce feeds greed, and greed breaks the second world apart. And then the world is again destroyed and people are protected and they withdraw and then reemerge. And in the third world, they grow and develop not just commerce but technology. And out of technology come very many good things, but also comes technological warfare. and that destroys the world, and so Taiwa allows it to be destroyed, and they withdraw and reemerge into the fourth world, which is this one. Hopefully having learned what they did learn before, but one of the destructions was precisely that. Yes, Nick?
I find it very interesting that when Spider-Woman is created, she asks, why am I here? And then when she in turn creates the twins, they ask, why are we here? Who are we? The deep existential question, you know, searching for some sort of significance. And then these creations are then in turn assigned specific roles to fulfill. And so I'm wondering if there's this inherent flaw, maybe, with all creation, where we need to be assigned a specific meaning or a specific purpose within the Hopi tradition.
What do you hear? Because that's a piece that I've been chewing on. Anyone else get snagged by that?
Say some more, Nick.
I like, Spider-Woman awakes to life, receives her name, and asks, why am I here? The receiving of the name precedes the existential question. And then the twins, who are not yet named, first say, who are we? And then say, why are we here? So naming is a crucial stage, it seems, in that process.
Yes. Anything that strikes, well, go ahead.
The answer to why am I here is interesting, because he says, look at the earth, but there's no life upon it. We see no joyful movement, we hear no joyful sound.
Yes.
That it's almost, it's answering that question in a sense, saying you're here to bring joy. Not just joy in general, but joyful movement and sound, almost like dancing and merriment. Going back to
what
that
is
idea.
Life without sound and movement?
Which reminds me of the celebration.
A bunch of things strike me. One is that in Western culture, when we ask, who am I? Why am I here? It is an existential, it's a question of existential angst, or at least we often figure it so. Here, it doesn't feel that way to me. As a long reader of existentialism in his Kierkegaardian and Sartrean forms and all the rest, I listen to this and it's more like, okay, I'm going to have to know who you're calling when you call me for lunch. So who am I, and what ought I to get on with doing?
It's almost as if they're reporting for duty.
Yes, here I am. And she says, this will be your duty. This is a simple question of function, which works very well in a very well-regulated Hopi village, where you live on the mesa if you have never lived off the mesa. And the mesa works by everyone knowing what they do, and everyone doing precisely that, and doing it well, and doing it cooperatively and collaboratively, and fitting into what their uncles have taught them to do, but they do it because they do it.
I saw it differently than
yes.
you did. I saw that the name was essential, was important, and perhaps it's my experience with Native American culture, where your name that you're given at birth, just what you're called, is really not significant. Your significant name is the name that you're given in your naming ceremony.
Yes.
And this felt more like the naming ceremony name, which
yes.
would also indicate your purpose. So
yes.
I have my name, I have my purpose. Now what am I to do?
Yes.
So it's not a question of the meaning of my life. I know the meaning of my life through my name. And I will now go forth and do what you asked me to do.
Yes, I like that way of saying it better than my way. What I was after was just, it's not existential angst. It's a much simpler thing, which says, human life has purposes. Tell me what mine is and I shall do it. Yeah. Okay.
So is there no existential angst in Hopi consciousness?
My friend Martin says there is not. I don't know that there is. Leslie Marmon Silko writes about Hopi and Navajo life. She's actually living in Pueblo herself. And tells stories that fit with things I hear from the Hopi folk we talked with. The angst is brought about by clash with outside culture. That's what I've been told. I don't know, I only have heard. And the tension, the friction is, what do you do when the outside world calls you to live off Mesa, because you then don't ever live again on top of the Mesa? How do you preserve this place so that we used to live down there, now we live up here, we lived down there until the Spanish came, now we live up here? How do you maintain that timeless reality? Silco writes as if that is not the subject of angst. As a Westerner, I have a very hard time imagining that. But it would not be the first time that I've encountered facets of a world, a Native American world, that I cannot imagine but also cannot deny. Birds talk to my friend Martin, and he's not a lunatic. I don't know. I don't hear birds. I don't see little people. But Martin does, and he navigates very well. Perhaps Hopi life is therefore without angst, though I cannot conceive of that.
Why not?
What's that?
Why can't you conceive of a life without angst?
Because as a Westerner, that is an attendant experience of our history of philosophy and our history of development. And
is that because of the fall of man?
What's that?
The fall of man?
We Westerners tell that story because we find in it something that focuses our angst, I think.
Perhaps the question for it in that culture then is to live with the community here or live with the community here.
Yeah.
And it's community. It's not where should I live as an individual? What's the meaning of my life? Community is everything.
Yes.
The life together is everything.
Yes.
So there's not the individual question. It's just a question of where
how the community survives. Yes.
Well, even within this story, it's a very collaborative affair of creation. Like when Sochuk Nang says, "Here's the earth we have created," it's never I did this, but it's we together do this. I need help with this, I will create something else to help me, but we're doing it all together, and it's not an individual affair.
Well, the question
that
I have
is absolutely crucial to this,
is that there is some need for order, which supposes that there's disorder, or there's no movement, there's no joy, that we said, those are ways in which you could say there's something lacking, there's something missing.
Or there can be something missing.
Yeah.
If there is disorder, order is missing. There is not yet movement or sound until it's created, and there's a lack therefore. Mm-hmm. So that this is a world that does not simply imagine simple motionless timelessness. It's a world that imagines a good way of living, but it's a good way of living that you achieve, that you arrive at, that you discover as part of a community in which you dwell, not a community for which you quest. Again, Lakota, it's not the same thing. But in one of the problems in South Dakota has been persistently that the Native American populations generate very bright students who would be college students, and they go off to college doing what all Westerners do. They go off to college, which is, by the way, a sort of vision quest, and lose themselves. Martin tells me that this is because Western images of coming of age always involve quest stories, whereas Native American stories of coming of age involve dwelling stories. This is surely a world where dwelling is how you come of age, remaining, settling in. This is a world in which you are not an adult until you are a little bit older than I am. Westerners, however, go questing for what will make them a full and real adult. We need to do the next part.
I was just going to try to think. But what if someone was given a name and they didn't feel like that was them?
Yeah.
Well, and then the Sioux expert, nor am I. I'm not Lakota, I grew up on a reservation. It's my thought that the name is thought of very carefully once your personality emerges. So I would imagine at times there would be people. I don't know if this naming, if there's a consultation beforehand. I don't know the process. I've been to naming ceremonies, but I don't know the prior process. But it's done when people's personalities emerge, oftentimes, like it can be at 18 or something.
I am going to borrow from a totally different tradition in a way that might not be appropriate and say that it may be like cultures in which arranged marriages still function. You know, if you're raised in a culture where that is the way of being, then it's kind of a chicken or the egg thing. The process works because everyone buys into the process. And so therefore, when you're given your name, if you're not entirely sure that it feels like who you are, you learn how to be your name because your name is who you are. And that's just the way the system works.
I really suspect that you're right on point. I suspect.
Sorry.
I know there's a lot of people on that that are very about.
Yeah, no, there can be. That's not to say that cultures that have arranged marriages or cultures where people are given their identity are more functional than this one, or that there isn't any more or less dysfunction than there would be in, say, the culture from which I come. But
and somehow there's always great. It strikes me that there's always great respect in the name that's chosen.
I want to mention one thing, and that is Spider Woman. You know, Spider Woman is a weaver, and I would imagine that weaving is very important in the Hopi culture. And weaving has a way of pulling things together.
Because it is always about pulling things together.
Oh.
Spider Woman is also a storyteller, which is a weaving and kind of pulling together.
Oh, it is 4 o'clock.
We have to stop. If you want to talk longer, I will talk for hours and hours. This is fascinating. Please carry this and look at the creation of humankind, because that act of creation is fascinating to look at next to Genesis 2. Again, as I said each day, this is never about which one is better, which one is right. I don't know, I don't care. What I'm interested in is when you put these two really beautifully interesting stories about how humankind comes to be human. You put them next to each other and knock them a little bit, you get great sparks. And there are some great sparks. Just a few from what we've said. Collaborative creation. If you drag that through Genesis 1 and 2, you notice a few things. You notice, of course, first of all, that God in Genesis 1 and 2 is the sole actor until it comes to be fruitful and multiply, when in fact the population of the earth is something in which all creation participates. That's an interesting thing. It is also
the pronoun we.
Yes, that's just where I'm going. It's also fascinating that when God in Genesis 1 makes humankind, God says, "Let us make humankind in our image and after our likeness." Biblical scholars go round and round and have a great time chasing their tails, because our tails are really fun to chase. People have supposed that this might be a reference to the heavenly court of angels who are participating. If that's what it is, it's collaborative creation. Others have supposed that this is the royal we. Queen Elizabeth says, "We are not amused, and you should pay attention." It's entirely possible. But whenever that comes onto the table, someone notices that Elohim, the name for God in Hebrew, is a plural. And whatever that goes back to, there is a plurality in God's unity that may in fact be collaborative. But the piece that may be worth just stopping on is noticing that the image of God in Genesis 1 is male and female. And there is therefore a we-ness to God. Let us make humankind in our image, male and female, God made them. That means that all of the interpreters that have spent their time arguing, and I have students that come to me and tell me, God has to be male or the Bible isn't true. Fascinating. The Bible says God is the image of God, the likeness of God, is male and female, and will accept nothing other than that. How does that make sense? That's what you have rabbis for, to argue about that for three or four millennia. That's what the problems... The rabbis say God, when God composed the Bible, God put puzzles in it that we will never solve, so that we will never be able to stop arguing about things that teach us truth. Here's the truth. The Genesis 1 story may be more collaborative than we have guessed. Huh. How odd. Now, tomorrow, we are doing an even longer story, and therefore we have to do it very differently. I'm going to send the story around. It is the Kumo Lipo, and a portion thereof. The entire Kumo Lipo is 2,000-some-hundred lines long, and ends with a genealogy that runs all the way up to David Kalakaua. We are not going to read all of that. But the base form of the Kumo Lipo, just the originating of the universe, is itself very long and goes through big, long chunks. Take this, read this, bring it back tomorrow so we don't have to cut down a lot of trees. If you find yourself unable to come back, just drop me the copy so I can hand it to the folks who can be here. But take it, read it, and play with it. Because tomorrow we're going to look at it and see what you notice. Come ready to point out pieces that we've got to burrow into, and we'll see how that goes. I'll take us burrowing in some interesting places also. Kumo Lipo is a fascinating story. Just look at it, we're going to mess with it. And one thing to think about, the other pieces that we've looked at have been stories. Kumo Lipo is a chant, and as a chant, it is a dance. What does it mean that this world created in the Kumo Lipo only exists when it is danced into being? You mess around with that and see what we can find. Thank you so much.
Thank you.